and yet we still have one left to go. There's one more, and you're not going to find it listed in an encyclopedia or any other list of world religions, except for my list, because I consider this a major dominant world religion. And it's the religion of what I call practical atheism. And it's the dominant religion of the United States. Practical atheism is any religious view that results in people living and thinking as if there were no God. Whether or not they claim to believe in God, the existence of God has no significant impact on their thoughts or actions. So some of them might say that they believe in God, others don't, but either way, you can't tell by looking at their life whether or not they believe in God or that they believe in God. It doesn't have any impact. This includes atheists, agnostics, as well as countless millions of religious people. Anyone who goes through life making decisions without reference to what God wants and without any reference to concern about divine justice. They don't seem to care. They don't seem to think that there's going to be any judgment day that they have to worry about. And so they just kind of exist as atheists would exist, regardless of what they claim. Now, where does practical atheism depart from the essentials of Christianity? The first point where they depart is in the belief that God is active in human affairs. Remember, that is one of the essentials. Not only do you believe in all the attributes of God, but the fact that God works and is active in human affairs, that He is busy, involved in everyday human life. That's one of the essentials in that. That's what the practical atheists don't believe. There are even thousands of people who consider themselves evangelical Christians, born-again Christians, who are really, if you just watch them, they're practical atheists. And I believe the primary driving force behind most modern practical atheism is scientism and evolutionism. Those two philosophies, scientism and evolutionism, I think, have had the largest effect on Christianity in our culture than any other false religion. Now let me tell you what I mean by scientism. Scientism is the driving force behind a lot of other isms. Naturalism, empiricism, logical positivism, philosophical materialism, and objectivism. And I want to go through and define each of those, because there's a lot of overlap, but they're similar. And I want you to see what those are, because they're all aspects of it. Scientism, in its mild form, is just the view that simply we should apply the scientific method, observation and testing, etc., all that stuff. That should be applied to any subject matter. The extreme form of scientism is the view that only scientific claims are meaningful. All other claims are not meaningful. That's scientism. Logical positivism is the view that a statement is meaningful only if it can be proved true or false by experience. Otherwise, it's meaningless. Naturalism is the view that holds that everything can be explained mechanistically by means of natural causes, not supernatural causes. The universe is just one big machine and it doesn't have any purpose or anything like that. It's just things happen because of the laws of physics and no other reason. Naturalism doesn't deny or affirm the existence of God. It just makes God an unnecessary hypothesis and essentially superfluous to the pursuit of knowledge. And that is music to our culture's ears. They don't mind believing in God as long as He's just not necessary and He's kind of off in the background. Our culture is very much into naturalism. When something happens, they don't say, "Why did God do this?" They say, "What physical natural forces caused this?" All right. Philosophical materialism. Materialism is the view that only matter exists. There is no immaterial world. There is no spiritual world. The only thing in existence is matter. Even your thoughts and emotions can be explained as just chemical reactions and electrical movements in the brain and nothing else. And then somebody asked about objectivism. I think Jude had mentioned objectivism a couple of weeks ago. Objectivism is a philosophical system of someone by the name of Ayn Rand. I don't know how to pronounce that, but it's based on the idea that truth is objective and not subjective. Now, let me just quickly explain what that means. Because some people wonder about what does that mean, objective, subjective. When you hear those terms in philosophy, the idea is Just remember, you are always the subject. And everything outside of you is an object. So, objective, somebody who believes in objective truth would say, okay, this stand has the properties of metal. It's made out of metal. It's hard, flat, smooth. Those are properties that are true of this object regardless of what's going on inside me, regardless of what I believe about this stand, regardless of how I feel about this stand, whether I even know about this stand or believe it's in existence or anything about this stand, doesn't affect one way or another the truth. The truth is inherent in the stand. That's objective. What's subjective is what's taking place inside me. How this stand affects me, how I feel about the stand, whether or not I really like the stand because it goes to any height that I need, or it'll hold my Bible. It's stiff enough, it'll hold my Bible, and yet it's not so stiff that I can't adjust it. It's the perfect music stand for a Sunday school class. Anyway, you didn't need all that subjective information. That's all what stuff's going on inside me. That's what it means, subjective, objective. Objectivism, the tenets of objectivism are reality exists as an objective absolute independent of man's feelings, wishes, hopes, or fears. Number two, reason is man's only means of perceiving reality, his only source of knowledge, his only guide to action, and his basic means of survival. Reason is the only way you can know things. Third, that which makes something virtuous is whether or not it's conducive to your survival. Survival is the highest good. Each person is an end in himself, not the means to the ends of others. He must exist for his own sake, neither sacrificing himself for others or sacrificing others for himself. The pursuit of his own rational self-interest and of his own happiness is the highest moral purpose in life. And then there's also a point they make a big deal about, their libertarian view of economics. That's kind of minor for Mike, as far as we're concerned. Very few, now those are just quick definitions. Very few people that you're going to bump into are going to identify themselves with those labels. So I don't want you to have to memorize those labels or anything. Those are philosophies. They're just philosophies that pervade every nook and cranny of our education system and the mass media. And the results are pieces and parts and bits and, of these philosophies seep into most Americans' belief systems at one point or another. You're not going to bump into a lot of people that say, well, I'm into logical positivism, you know, or something. But 90% of the time, when you just bump into some secular person, the reason he's secular is because he's highly influenced by some combination of these ideas that I just went over. In their purest forms, most of these philosophies are simple to refute because they're self-contradictory. I mean, we can just dispatch with them quickly. For example, we'll just take them in reverse order. Objectivism is very easy to refute. The first two points of objectivism we totally agree with, right? Reality exists as objective, absolute, independent of my feelings. I mean, that's true. And number two, I agree with number two. Reason is our means of perceiving reality. But then, the rest of the points, well, especially the next two, go on to completely violate the first two points. Survival is the highest good. How can you prove that to me objectively? They believe survival is the highest good. That's totally subjective. It arose out of Ayn Rand's inner feelings. Rand just simply feels like that's the highest good, and that's why it's the highest good. And there's no objective reality you can point to say that that's the highest virtue. It's the same thing with the next point. The objectivist believes that man exists for his own sake without any self-sacrifice. He must, and that, I mean, why is that true? How do you know for sure that's true? He believes that's true because he just wants that to be true. There's no objective proof of that. So they violate their own system. It starts out good and then it goes south when it gets to ethics. And it has to go south when it gets to ethics. Unless there's a God who has declared something good or bad, there's no objective way to know that anything is good or bad, beautiful or ugly, virtuous or evil, right or wrong. And so if you're going to discount God, you're hopelessly going to be self-contradictory unless you just reject the concepts of good and bad altogether. So it's self-contradictory, self-refuting. Same thing with materialism. The philosophical materialist believes that the only matter exists. Now that belief, does that belief exist? Is that belief made out of matter? No. And so by merely suggesting the idea, you're refuting it. Naturalism. Everything is just a mechanistic process. But what mechanistic process, physical mechanistic process, causes somebody to become a naturalist instead of a theist?
Then you have to go into the idea that your thoughts are a matter of chemical reactions.
Still, though, even if you just talk about the mechanics of your thinking process, you have to, I mean, it seems to me you have to admit that there is an immaterial side to a thought that is, that it has an effect, a physical effect on you, but clearly, when a person becomes a naturalist, what is a naturalist? Why? What does a naturalist care what chemicals are running around in my brain? Why is he trying to persuade me of naturalism? If it's just one set of electrical impulses and chemicals, as opposed to a different configuration of those chemicals, what meaning is there to that? There's some meaning to the idea itself. Logical positivism. Why can't I say positivism on my first try? I always get it right on my second try. Never once got it on my first try. Anyway, logical positivism. A statement is meaningful if and only if it can be proved true or false by means of experience. Well, is that a statement? Yes. Can it be proved true or false through experience? No. So it refutes its own view. According to the rules of positivism, the idea of positivism has no meaning. There, I got it the first time and not the second time. Okay. Scientism is the other one. It claims that only scientific claims have meaning. Well, is that a scientific claim? No, philosophical one. Therefore, if it's true, it's not meaningful. So scientism, by its own rules, is either false or meaningless. So, in their purest form, they're all self-contradictory, but most people don't hold these ideas in their purest form. They're just influences that form the backdrop of most people's subconscious thinking about religion. There's just a general sense in our culture that empirical, physical, verifiable, observable, testable things are the surest realities. And that spiritual realities either don't exist, or they exist but have no meaning or significance, or they maybe exist and have meaning, but they can't be known with any certainty. And either, whichever of those three you pick, the result is all the same, practical atheism. Living in a way that's indistinguishable from the way that an atheist would live, because there's no evidence that you believe in God from the way that you live and think. So the goal of this class this morning is not to debunk the pure forms of the philosophies. The goal of this class this morning is to get us started thinking about which points we should be skeptical about scientists' claims, and to point out other valid methods for verifying truth other than just science. I think our culture suffers from a blind faith in scientists and an overconfidence in what scientists say. We need some more skepticism when it comes to science. Just as people are naturally skeptical about the supernatural, we should also be skeptical about scientists. Let me ask you this question. How much can we know from science? Everything? No. If not, then there are limits. And the question is, what are the limits? At what point of the pursuit of knowledge does our scientific information stop helping us? And keep this in mind. The issue isn't primarily science. The issue is scientists. If you're a Christian, people are going to belittle you by saying that you're anti-science at some point if you believe in miracles and God and so on, supernatural, or that science proves you wrong somehow. Whenever that happens, be sure to correct that statement and say, no, science doesn't tell us anything. Only scientists tell us things. We all agree that science is a wonderful tool that helps us discover or verify many things that are true, but science is not a magic tool that somehow is not subject to human error. The truth is, professional people who hold scientists on a pedestal is way beyond what's human. And we have to get people to admit, just like professional athletes and doctors and philosophers and theologians are capable of making mistakes, so even scientists are capable of errors, right? Even scientists. Amen from a seasoned scientist. We know this for sure because, obviously, some scientists say things that contradict what other scientists say. So it's obvious somebody has to be making a mistake. When a scientist makes a truth claim, the question isn't whether science is correct. Science is just a tool. The question should always be, how much possibility is there for error in this particular truth claim? And that's what we have not learned in our culture to analyze. People have an overconfidence in the conclusions of scientists because they have an oversimplified view of what science is. You know, people think, well, science is looking at something in a microscope. Scientists tell us that matter is made up of tiny little particles. And you can, anyone can just go by a microscope, look through there, and see, there's the little tiny particles. How can you argue with that? You can just see it. And people think that's a science. Well, a scientific claim that's that simple, it's right for us to have a high level of confidence in a claim like that because it doesn't involve very much opportunity for error. Assuming your slide is clean and so on. But what people don't seem to realize is that there many scientific theories involve enormous possibilities for error. And there are various kinds of errors. For example, whenever anyone, including a scientist, draws a conclusion from data, even if the data is good data, there's a possibility for logical errors, right? Is it possible for a scientist to make a logical error? Yes. There are many scientists who have a very poor command of logic. One of them is Alfred Kinsey, who's had an enormous effect on our society. He's one of the major reasons we have the problem with the sexual immorality that we have today. He was a horrible, horrible person that did unspeakable things to children and so on. But anyway, he's the one that scientifically proved that 10% of the population are homosexuals. Based on the scientific studies of this scientist, that 10% figure has been declared as a fact by Newsweek, Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times, just to name a few. And numerous laws have been passed based on this statistic. His method was to get a whole bunch of people and ask them if they were homosexual or if they'd had any homosexual activity in their life. But the way he got his samples was by asking for volunteers. And the problem with that is even Abraham Maslow, the famous psychologist, warned Kinsey at the time. This is back around 1950 or so. He said, look, if you ask for volunteers on something like that, it's going to skew the results because, generally speaking, people who will volunteer for a survey like that are going to have a much more of a propensity towards exhibitionism and other sexual deviations because they're willing to expose their sexual life. And Kinsey ignored that. And his sample ended up being so skewed, it was made up of 25% prison convicts. 78% of his sample were outside of the norm of the general population, including pedophiles and all kinds of social deviants. And then he took a conclusion. He asked a bunch of inmates or convicts, if you've ever been involved with homosexual behavior, 10% say yes. And so you say, okay, that represents the general population. That is a logical error. So scientists can make logic errors. They can also make errors of fact. No human being has all the facts. If you draw conclusions about something while being misinformed about pertinent facts, your conclusions may be an error. Ptolemy was a brilliant scientist, but he didn't have access to certain information, and so he convinced the people of his day that the earth was fixed and the sun revolved around the earth. Now, he wasn't an idiot. He just lacked certain information. Another example is Darwin, who built his entire theory based on the belief that the cell was an extremely basic, simplistic form of life that could easily come into existence by chance. Darwin had no way of knowing what we know today. The cell is complex beyond comprehension. And you can, I had a friend who took a graduate level course for a whole semester on introduction to the cell. Incredibly complex. And even if you ignore the vast complexity of human cells and just look at the blue-green algae cell, which evolutionists believe to be among the first cells that came into existence because they're so simple in comparison to other cells. I mean, cells of blue-green algae have just one molecule of DNA, and they don't even have internal structures like a nucleus and so on that you would expect in a cell. Even those super simple cells, a bacterium of blue-green algae can synthesize some 3,000 to 6,000 compounds at a rate of 1 million reactions per second. Now, science has not observed machines with that kind of efficiency organizing themselves spontaneously just because a pond of slime gets hit by lightning. And had Darwin known some of the basic facts about cells, no doubt he would have made some different assumptions. So scientists are capable of making logical errors and factual errors, because nobody has all the facts. They're also capable of making errors rooted out of bias. Now, this is where some scientists would object and say, no, all human beings have biases except us. We're above that. We're exempt from being human beings. No. They're human beings too, and they can have biases too. In fact, you can demonstrate scientifically that scientists have biases, right? Just like all the rest of us, scientists really want to believe some things and really want other things to turn out not to be true. There's no question. If there's a scientist who knows for a fact that if he rejects evolutionary theory, he's going to lose his prestigious position at his university, his writings will no longer be taken seriously, he won't be published, he'll be mocked by his colleagues, and worst of all, he may be put into a position of having to acknowledge that he is answerable to a creator with his life. With all that motivation, it's going to be very, very hard for him to be honest with any data that opposes his evolutionary theory. So, contrary to popular opinion, while science itself is a wonderful tool, scientists are subject to errors. They're not omniscient. They're not even infallible. And their findings are not inerrant. So the question with any scientific conclusion isn't, is it scientific or unscientific? That's the wrong question. The question is, how much possibility for error is there in this particular theory? If it's based on a tiny sample, there's a large possibility for error. If there was a lot of pressure for this scientist to come up with that conclusion, or if it meant a large grant for him financially, there's a large possibility for error. If there are a lot of unknown factors involved, there's a huge possibility for error. I love astronomy. I've always been fascinated by that particular study. I love to read about galaxies and stars and nebula, black holes, pulsars, and all that, antimatter and everything. If ever, I usually don't read a whole newspaper article, but if I ever see one about a new discovery in outer space, I always read every word of it. I'm fascinated with that stuff. So I love that realm of scientific study. However, all of the things that I've read, all the things that I believe about outer space, I hold very lightly and tentatively because there's so many unknowns involved out there. There's too many things we just don't know. And some realms of study, and I think that's one of them, scientists are a little bit overconfident in their ability to know everything. For example, this is just one example. A huge amount of what we believe about the universe are things that we figured out based on the speed of light, right? If it turned out that the speed of light varied in ways that we weren't aware of, then all bets are off as far as distances and sizes of everything in outer space. I clipped an article last year, an AP article from the newspaper. I have it sitting on my desk right now. The headline was, "Speed of Light Exceeds Its Own Limit." That's garbage. That's garbage. What was the deal with that?
The media gets a hold of scientific, real scientific articles, but not So typewriter and find something fascinating and miraculous is this drug. So all readers will read all scientists in the room and say, this is a drug.
Well, what happened with that? Do you know about that particular experiment?
They're talking, so technically they're talking about what's called the phase velocity of light, not the group velocity of light. There's two different parts of defining how a wave travels, okay? And the technical definition, the one which is actually the definition of speed of light is the group velocity. Say, you know, how long does it take something to hit from point A to B? Not how fast is something moving inside of this little thing.
Okay. So what that was about was they sent light, a pulse of light, through a encased thing of cesium, and based on the effects of that, evidently the people who wrote the article misinterpreted the fact that light appeared to be going fast. Anyway, the point that I was going to make, I'll still make, because it doesn't really matter to me whether this particular interpretation of this scientific thing is valid or not, because the point that I was going to make is there are some things that could affect our perception of light that we don't know about. I mean, we don't have any idea. We can measure, I mean, we can send something to the moon and test if our calculations about the moon are right. Sure enough, they are. It's fairly close. We can do that with some planets. But when you start getting outside the solar system and then outside of the galaxy and then beyond other galaxies, you're dealing with such vast distances that if there's some factor out there that we are unaware of that affects the way light seems to be approaching us, then that could throw everything off. And so I'm open, even though I generally believe that if they say that Betelgeuse is, you know, 100 light years away or whatever, I generally think in terms of, well, it's probably that far away. But if some evidence were to come up to show, oh, maybe it's a lot closer or a lot farther, then I'm going to be much more open to that than I would be if someone came along and said, well, the moon is a different distance. You see what I'm saying? Because there's so many unknowns. The farther away you get, there's more unknowns. Somebody making a comment? Okay. All right. So thanks for preventing me from making a fool of myself on that particular point. But anyway, the point still stands. There are, the more unknowns, the more lightly you have to hold the fact. Okay. When a scientist looks at a rock, and based on what he observes and what he knows about what happens to rocks, he forms a theory about what has taken place with that rock over the last 6 months, he may be on very solid footing. And he can even test his... there might be some possibilities for error, but he can... It could be there are no errors. He could test his theory over the next 6 months and see if it works out. If he tries to draw a conclusion based on what happened 100 years ago to that rock, there are a much, much more wider field of unknowns. There's more possibility for error. Still, maybe there's some historical information he can get a hold of and test his theory from 100 years ago and verify it. Make it 1,000 years and you really increase the possibility of error even more. Once you push something past written history, several thousand years ago, 6,000 or 8,000, whatever the earliest written history is, then you have no way to test the accuracy of the theory. You come up with a theory and you just have to hope it's right because you can't test it. And it can become so subject to error. There's so many possibilities of unknowns that it's questionable how useful it can be. So whenever you hear a scientific claim, ask yourself how much possibility for error is there, and that'll tell you how tightly or how loosely to hold that claim. Now, on top of that, skepticism, we should add the fact that there are other avenues for finding truth besides science. Scientism says science is the only valid way to find truth, but actually there are other ways. For things that are observable, science is great. But what about for an incident that happened 2 months ago? You can't observe it. What about someone's emotional experience? Or what about the war in Afghanistan? Do you have to be in Afghanistan to know anything about the war? For those kinds of things, we rely on a different source of learning truth, and that source is very, very similar to science because it's based on observation. Science begins with observation. The fundamental assumption of science is that there's a real world out there, and we can gain information, accurate information about that world through our senses. That you have to assume. Now, some philosophers say that's a bad assumption. For all we know, our senses are way off, and we have no idea what the world... But if you're going to assume that, then it's all hopeless anyway. I mean, then you can't do anything. But if you start out, the scientist starts out by saying, no, our senses can give us accurate information about the world. We'll assume that. And so most of what scientists believe about the world really doesn't come from the experiments that they've done themselves, right? Most of what scientists believe, they believe based on what other scientists have observed and written about. Ideally, in order to verify something is true, you can reproduce it in a lab when that's possible. That gives us a high degree of certainty. But that's not the only way you can know for sure that something happened. Not everything can be reproduced. For example, a person could get struck by lightning and survive. Now, that happens from time to time. Now, if you go into a lab and you have a scientist shock people with the same amount of electricity and reproduce lightning in the lab, and, you know, it'll kill person after person after person, and you say, wow, this isn't working, you know, and still, I believe that a person can survive a lightning strike in some cases, even though even if it hasn't been reproduced in a lab and I've never seen it with my own eyes, I still believe it happens. My being convinced that it happens is based on eyewitness testimony of many people. So many people have observed it that I accept it. I don't doubt it. One of the ways that we know about things that we haven't observed with our own eyes is through the testimony of others. And that is another valid way to gain information. It is also subject to error. As with scientific studies, though, the probability of the error can be assessed and taken into consideration. Every one of us, when we hear someone give an account of having seen the Loch Ness Monster, makes judgments about how reliable the person is. We say, you know, is he lying? What's the likelihood that he's lying? What's the likelihood that he misinterpreted what he saw? He saw a big log, you know, or something. What is the likelihood that his eyes are playing tricks on him? It's always dark and fuzzy. Just as science is not a foolproof way of gaining knowledge, and yet it is a valid one, so eyewitness accounts are not a foolproof way of learning truth, and yet it is valid. Think of how much of what you know and what you believe based on what people told you. Think of it. 99.9% of all the scientific information you believe because not because you witnessed the experiments yourself, but simply because of eyewitness accounts of scientists that you've read or heard. Fact is, you believe the vast majority of everything you're told. You believe that? If you come into your house and your wife says, Johnny was jumping up on the couch and knocked a lamp down, busted it, and whatever, you don't conduct an investigation. You just accept that it happened. Immediately, as fact. Unless there's some compelling reason to doubt someone, you generally believe what you're told. When a police officer says this road is closed, you assume the road is closed. When the guy at Taco Bell says your order is 1583, you figure it must be 1583.
No.
Depending on the way the guy looks, you may count it up yourself. You couldn't live life if you had to verify everything you were told. The only way to get through life is to just simply believe everything you're told unless there's some compelling reason to doubt it. You start out believing, and then if there's a compelling reason to doubt it, you doubt it. Now, not only is science not the only way to verify truth and learn truth, but many times it's not even the best way. In some cases, eyewitness testimony is a better source of knowledge than science. For example, suppose there's a top scientist who exhumed the remains of a body and applied all his scientific knowledge to the question of what caused the death, and you're trying to find out what killed this person. And since it is so decomposed from a long time ago, and all that's left is bone, the scientist maybe puts a little bone fragment under his microscope, does all kinds of studies, and finds the presence of something that could be explained by a fatal disease. And so he develops a theory that the person died of a fatal disease. And he showed you all the evidence and how fatal this disease is and so on, you'd probably be persuaded. But now suppose you find out that the body was the body of Abraham Lincoln. Now, if that happened, would you change your opinion about how Lincoln died? No. You'd say, Lincoln was shot. People saw it. We know he was shot. If he had this disease, he had it. He didn't die of the disease. He died of a bullet wound. Because we have a more accurate source of information, history. We have all those eyewitness accounts. So we wouldn't accept the scientist's theory. Does that make us unscientific? No, not at all. Scientists routinely reject theories of other scientists. Just because a theory is based on scientific observations does not mean that the theory has to be correct, because there's a possibility of error in the interpretation. If there's a car accident, the judge trying to figure out who's at fault, he could do a scientific analysis of the tensile strength of the metal and the damage, and calculate the skid marks, and analyze all that stuff and whatever. But it's much more reliable, really, to just simply ask the five guys that were standing there and saw the whole thing what happened. So unless there's a reason to doubt, eyewitness testimony is really a very good source of information. Now, what constitutes a compelling reason to believe or not believe some eyewitness testimony? And that is a question of great concern throughout the law courts for thousands of years, obviously, since you have to listen to people's testimony. And it's no surprise that we have people who are experts at that very question. The study of forensic evidences, legal evidences, that is, evidences that are admissible in a court of law. And there are basic principles that most of us just use intuitively to find out if people are reliable or not. And they've figured out what some of them are. Let me just give you a couple. I'm not going to do a whole exhaustive thing on it. Just an example so you know what I'm talking about. History is considered much more reliable when the writer seems unequivocally able to substantiate what he's saying. If you can tell that he has a confidence that this is not disputable, this is not disputed, everybody agrees with this, that tends to make it more reliable. Another example, a statement that I read from one of these experts, he said, a truthful witness is artless and disdains effect. That means when a person is just telling you what happened, and some of what he says seems to favor the prosecution, some of what he says seems to favor the defense, and he doesn't really seem to be concerned with presenting any kind of compelling, persuasive thing, he's just saying what he saw, that lends a lot of credibility to that particular witness. When you have another witness, I mean, suppose you got a witness that says, look, I saw someone leave the building. I'm pretty sure it was the defendant. He looks just like him. Although, you know, the guy I saw was clean-shaven, this guy has a beard, but I don't know. It seems like it was him. Anyway, I know I saw someone. If you got a guy like that, that's much more believable than if you have someone that says, that's the guy I saw. I swear on my mother's grave, that's the guy. That jerk is the idiot that I saw coming out of that building. You know, if a guy presents it like that, you can tell he's got a little bit of an agenda and that you wonder how believable he can be. So those are just a couple of many, many principles in evaluating someone's credibility. And we're very sophisticated in our ability to determine the truthfulness of a witness. And the greater the number of witnesses to an event, the greater our ability to compare and find out exactly what happened. So this is just an introduction. We're going to continue this next Sunday. I didn't want to try and do it all in one Sunday, because especially in a potluck, because I realize you're hungry. But I just want to lay a foundation today. There should be a healthy skepticism of science. I'm not anti-science. I love science. I love the fact that God has given us the ability to know how things work, and He's made things consistent so we can operate our lives. However, we need to be skeptical and realize when there are large possibilities of error and when there are small possibilities of error, so that we know how strongly to hold a theory. Secondly, there are other ways to find out truth other than science. Eyewitness accounts are an excellent way. And you'll see how this will all come together. But next week we're going to address these questions. In ages past, people used to always attach unexplainable phenomena to the gods because they had no other explanation. And now, in our age of scientific enlightenment, we understand natural causes for some of the things that people used to attribute to the gods. Couldn't that be the case? still today with the things that we attribute to God, maybe 100 years from now, scientists will say, oh, no, that's just explainable by nature. Is that a possibility? Should we be open to that? Are we guilty of divine fallacy, what they call, what some people accuse us of, the divine fallacy? Divine fallacy is anytime you see something you don't understand, you just say, oh, God must have done it. That's actually a fallacy, a logical fallacy. Are we guilty of that? What is the purpose of miracles? How should we respond to miracles? When we see a miracle, should we say, well, we just don't... Should we attribute it and say that's proof of God's action? Or should we be open to the idea, well, maybe it's just we don't have the scientific knowledge to understand why that could happen? What does the Bible teach about the purpose of miracles? And boy, this is important beyond just this class, but it's important for you to know because there's a lot of confusion about that. How much evidence should we require to believe a miracle? I mean, lots of religions claim lots of miracles. How solid should the evidence, the eyewitness evidence, be before we should be willing to stake our lives on it? And what about warnings not to be led astray by miracles performed by Satan? How do we know which are which? So that's some of the stuff from next time.
Are you up for questions?
Yes, we can take a few questions, and then we'll wrap it up. Any
Anyone
comments? She just wanted to make sure we had time.
Laura told me that she saw Elvis.
I believe it. I don't have any reason to doubt that.
Just curious. So, I mean, if you were to
if you have a difference of opinion about what scientific claims are more reliable or less reliable than I do, that's really neither here nor there. One of us is just wrong, or both of us. But that's not the issue. All I'm trying to urge is healthy dose of skepticism. What I'd like to do is depose the idol of scientism. While holding up science as a wonderful gift from God, our culture has made an idol out of scientism and overbelieved it. And so you got a situation. You got people like me who read an article in the paper that's bogus and tend to accept it because we saw it in the paper. I mean, that tends to be our society's approach to science, and I think we need to be more responsible in what we accept as valid, persuasive truth.
But what would you say if a scientist's logical positivist is naturalistic, philosophical, materialistic, objective, difficult person says to you that 99.9% of what I believe is from what I read and Bible and other things?
If somebody accused me of believing everything that based on...
Our belief in the Bible is based on what someone else wrote or someone else's account.
Right.
I mean, what do you say to that?
Well, I just point out the fact that 99.9% of what he believes is also from other people's accounts.
And then we're going to have an argument on whose accounts are more.
Exactly. That's exactly what the argument should be. Whose accounts are more believable? Whose should we believe? Everybody believes what they believe based on other people's accounts. The question is, which accounts are reliable and which ones aren't? And so that's exactly the question.
Wow. You
going to
do this in one
Sunday school? Well, I'll start it next. We'll see.
You ought to start praying for
Yeah, we do need to do that because if we don't have enough evidence to where we should be willing to base our lives on the fact that the miracles that Jesus performed actually happened, and the resurrection happened, then maybe we should consider bailing out of Christianity because it might not be true.
Okay.
That's the...
That's
what I'm saying. Because that's the... Because I'm gonna, another thing I'm going to talk about next week is blind faith. What does the Bible teach about faith? If some people say, hey, if faith is based on evidence, then it's not faith. I contend it is faith, and all true faith is based on adequate evidence, and any faith that's not based on adequate evidence is just foolishness rather than faith.
And my other question is, where does emotionalism fit into Christianity? I mean, we are subjective.
Right.
It's not an objective.
I'm glad you asked that, because I need to clear something up. Some people have been a little confused when I use the term emotionalism. I mean that in a much different way than when I just say emotions. Emotions are good. If you're going to be like God, you're going to have to be emotional, because God is the most emotional being there is. Emotions are a wonderful part of who we are. Emotionalism, when I say emotionalism, I'm talking about unethical manipulation by means of people's emotions. When I persuade somebody to walk down an aisle by means of music and all kinds of appeal to their emotions without appealing to their mind and their will, then I have done an unethical thing, because I persuaded them to sidestep that part of them that is a very important part, and that is their intellect. Emotions aren't bad, but when you bypass the intellect by using emotionalism, then you've done an unethical thing.
But then you could still say, how do emotions fit into Christianity? Because it doesn't seem to fit into time.
Well,
it's close to death and objective.
Yeah, and I think there are objective truths. And I mean, there are subjective truths. Not all truth is subjective. That's what we're totally against, that idea. But there are some truths that are subjective. That is, there are some, it's a little fuzzy. How I feel inside me is an objective truth, too, because it's objectively true. If I feel bad, then it's objectively true for every human being in the world that I feel bad. You know, so truth is not subjective, but there are objective truths about the subjective things that go on inside us.
Okay.
So I don't know if that helps. All right.
So, I mean, you said you're looking, and you're trying to be skeptical.
Right.
It's a kind of equivalent. I'm wondering if you're looking at it.
Absolutely. We need to be responsible in what we believe, whether it's about a claim about a miracle or something in the Bible or a claim about a rock that a scientist is making. You know, we need to apply valid skepticism. We don't want unbelief. Unbelief is irrational because it refuses to believe even in the face of valid evidence. Nor do we want blind faith on the other side, where we just accept something because we like the source, and we haven't considered the validity of the claim. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead and follow up that question, and then we'll get that question.
See, we're kind of like sophisticated Christians.
What we are scientists that are so sophisticated that we're Christians. We have followed science to what a logical conclusion of science should be, and that is, we've observed what God has made and we've turned to God.
It's just like in the past, it's kind of Christians don't want to seem like they're... I grew up in a different time, in a different world. People have to believe the world is flat today.
Mm-hmm. You know why they believe that? No, that's not why they believe it. They believed it because they listened too much to the scientists of the day. You know, and that's a great point, because back at the time of Ptolemy, the theologians listened to Ptolemy, the great scientist, said the sun goes around the earth. And they made it a point of doctrine. And so that when Copernicus came around, and he just told the theologians, just look in the telescope, will you? They wouldn't look. Because they couldn't accept the truth, because they'd already connected it with doctrine. That's what we have to avoid doing. That's what we have to avoid doing, is taking what the scientists say and trying to say, hey, you know, we want credibility with the scientists. And they say, hey, that's right here in Genesis. You know, see this? You can just twist this around, and sure enough, there you have millions of years. And once we connect their theories with the Bible, then some other scientist comes along, proves their theory wrong. All the scientists say, oh, okay, I guess that was wrong. And we're stuck having to hold on to this dumb theory because we've connected it with the Bible. So we don't want to make the same mistake again.
I agree with that. I don't know if Ptolemy is a good example or not. Because prior to Ptolemy, the tools of the theologians of the world is the center of the universe. Ptolemy gave us some contrary to credibility. And it's true that wasn't embraced by the church because it did fit with their what they wanted to believe.
Yeah. Well, there wasn't a huge distinction between theologians and scientists then, like there is now. So you're right. It went both ways. The scientists were affected by what their theological beliefs called for.
The theologians were along and said, well, that's what Aquinas is saying. It meshes with what we're saying to the unbreakable.
Right. Yeah. Right. You're right. And so that just goes to show you the importance that theologians don't misinterpret the Bible. When we, you know, when we misinterpret the Bible, we get ourselves in a world of hurt.
Well, you know, just, I know y'all want to eat, but...
Yeah.
Really,
nah, we're fine.
Tell me a hush. The more science is uncovered, it seems to validify Christianity.
Right. Well, yeah. And that's the thing. If you really believe Christianity is true, then you're not going to be afraid of science because you're just going to assume it's going to keep on validating Christianity.
I mean, you listen to accounts of astronauts in outer space, and they look at, you know, that feeling, and they have written, you know, there has to be a God.
Some of them have. Others haven't. Some have gotten up there and says, well, I'm up here, and I don't see God anywhere. Yeah. And some people have said, well, if he just would have taken off that spacesuit, then he would have. But anyway. Jack?
Go over the time when Jesus appears to the apostles and Thomas says, you know, I'm going to let him put my finger into his hand, and Jesus is here. You know, and then he says, but blessed are those who have not seen and believed.
Right. Yeah, I'll talk about that next week because that's worth spending a little time on. Here's the question to think about through the week. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Thomas doubting, good thing or bad thing? And I'll give you my view on that next week. All right. Okay, let's close in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time together, and we thank you for science. We thank you for making this world act in consistent ways so that we can anticipate what's going to happen. We can count on things like gravitational pull and electrical current and all these things to consistently act so that we can do wonderful things in your world and make things and send out radio broadcasts with your world with your word that can change people's hearts. And we thank you so much that radio waves are consistent and that we can predict things. And so, Lord, we praise you for the creation that you made. And we pray that you would protect us from arrogance and thinking that people are foolish if they disagree with us on minor points, things like that. And yet, I pray that you would prevent us from falling into the trap of worshiping scientism like our culture and being worried that maybe your word won't hold up. Pray that we would have a great faith and trust in you, but that faith would be based on adequate evidence so that it might be solid. Thank you for providing that evidence for us, Lord. And we pray all of this in your holy and wondrous name. Amen.